In a recording of a talk given by Annie Pemachedron, a woman asks her for advice on how to get seriously lighthearted. The context of that question was just following the appointment of George W. Bush as president. So as you can imagine, it still fits today. In activist circles, the toxicity of call-out culture, the high rate of burnout when there's just so much to be done, and the overload of information we face every single day could all be eased with a little sense of humor. Today, I collaborate with Jess Pettit, a diversity trainer with a seriously lighthearted approach. She describes humor as a heartbeat, contributing to a more flexible and spacious way of being. Jess is also full of pithy stuff that she admits sounds a bit like a bumper sticker, but is totally true. Like, I am the best tool anybody has for my work. And if I'm doing anything because I think it's going to reduce the amount of fear in the world, at the heart, that's good. And my personal favorite, when did our ego get involved in the conversation about what is the right thing to do? Hi, Jess. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So to begin, the question that I always ask my guests is just to share a little bit about when you were growing up or when you were younger and at what point it was that you started to really step into being in the realm of service.
So that's a really funny question to ask me because I actually don't remember a time where either I wasn't encouraged or I didn't just naturally gravitate to really challenging topics or really scary conversations that I felt the people I was around were too scared to have. So then I feel like I stepped into it to either make it more comfortable for them or actually just started facilitating the conversations or doing research or something like that, which is a little bit different than how most people would describe service, but I think that's probably what I have come to find is my main calling in service.
What was your specific experience then? Like, was it as a child? Was it just sort of like your family as a unit did service work or however you want to call it?
Yeah, I grew up with parents that very much felt like they needed to fill voids that no one else was filling. And I had very strong role models for that. So my mother started the teachers union in the state of Texas because there wasn't one. And my father was a professional athlete and actually started, I don't think they would use the word union at the time, but standards for the sport of powerlifting, which was his sport of choice. To help competitors get access to the sport, as well as being able to promote like healthy, drug-free competition. So I think I watched them do that. And then I remember like one of the earliest stories I remember is in sixth grade was our first research project. What we were told to do was to do a research project on a topic that we knew nothing about that we would be able to find information about. I think if that It was Mrs. Collingsworth. I remember her name, but I can't remember the exact instructions of the assignment. However, I had decided to do sodomy laws and how I didn't feel that it was fair because heterosexual people could do anything they wanted to that didn't result in pregnancy as long as it was consensual, but not heterosexual people couldn't do anything that also felt good, even if it was the same activity that straight people could do.
Oh, so hold on. You were in grade 6 when you did this?
Yes.
So you were 12.
Yes.
That's amazing.
Yeah, I thought it was ridiculous. What I really love about my parents is, like, here's a library. Let's go research it and figure it out. And so I was looking at different state amendments to state constitutions. I was going through federal court cases of why it would ever be okay for one type of person to be permitted to do something, but one type of person not to be permitted to do something. That led me down to probably a decade worth of obsession about Holocaust research because I felt like I was the only person as a kid in Texas who noticed that Adolf Hitler was brunette, but was talking about the perfect Aryan. Like, did anyone not notice that he was not blonde? Anyway, it was fascinating to me, these obvious contradictions. And so that's just kind of what I leaned into as a hobby.
Wow, that's fabulous.
or lonely.
So a big part of doing this kind of work, and something that comes up a lot when I'm talking to other people who are in this work of social action or social restoration or whatever you want to call it, is the work of examining and relating to our own experience and identity, and then seeing how that connects us to others. And I think that that kind of feeds in well with something that you said in the TED Talk that you gave. You said, take responsibility for the stories we write and leave room for edits.
Yes.
So I wanted to know, what have you learned about making room for edits in your own experience and your own identity over time?
I think the biggest thing that I've learned is that I demand other people do it for me, and then often I feel too lazy to do it for other people. So I try to take responsibility for the fact that I expect it from others. So the least I can do is like really try to pay attention and to leave room for other people's truths to edit my own narrative that I've written about someone else based on my judgments and assumptions that are informed by my lived experience, that teach me how to feel safe or prepared in order to interact with this person. So then I kind of enter into an interaction, even if it's over cantaloupes at the grocery store, but I lean in with my lived experience, knowing that it might not be accurate. And that is a practice I have to literally practice. But for some reason, I don't need to practice that I expect everyone to do that to me as we begin to engage.
That's often the case, isn't it? Like, it would be so much easier if it wasn't for other people.
There's a theme.
So what has been your personal experience of like that, like your identity and what you've learned from looking at your own story and the own edits that you have in your identity?
Man, that is a really good question. I don't know that I can say like, oh, it's this. I did a pro bono training today for a charter school. So I spoke with the middle schoolers and the high schoolers, and it was such a powerful experience to remember, like, even though I may feel insecure or lack confidence or, you know, fake it till you make it kind of stuff as a 43-year-old, being in a room with 50 people under the age of 16, one person today had a driver's license, 50 people under the age of 16, and the sheer amount of like self-doubt mixed with self, like, doesn't even start with the word self, like just complete lack of recognition that self is present, mixed with the third major ingredient of holy smelly hormones, right? I literally like took a deep breath with my nose pinched to realize that like I really have come a long way in my own self-awareness and self-reflection work. And I thought for today, it just was such a powerful moment because I'm so hard on myself. And like, the more you know, the more you don't know, and you can get trapped in this loop. But like, I'm so much more solid and confident in this bucket of hot mess that I call myself. And it's taken, you know, 30 years to get here. And I don't know that I've spent enough time, that would be my takeaway for today. I don't know that I've spent enough time really understanding the commitment to that journey. And, you know, hopefully I have 30 more years to go, but like, wow, I'm more on top of it than I give myself credit for.
What are some of the practices that you use when you notice something like that you're not leaving room for other people's edits and your perception of them, or when you notice that you're being really hard on yourself?
Or you mean like when I'm awake? I think it's sometimes the most benevolent thing one can do for yourself, I can do for myself, is like, oh, I did that again. Okay. You know, like, don't get dramatic about it. Don't make a big deal. Don't, you don't always have to like shave your head to like mark this period in time. But you can just be like, wow, that is still a pattern. Huh. All right. One of the things I talk about in my book is you need to be able to be self-aware enough to develop three piles. And one pile is, I really like this stuff about me. It is really congruent with who I am and my values and how I want to be on the planet this life. And then the second pile is, I really do not like this about myself. It is not congruent with who I am. And these are things I really need to focus on and work on. Right? So those are the extremes. Mm-hmm. The vast majority of yourself, and I'm air quoting around the word self, is whether you do or do not like it, it is incongruent. Mm-hmm. And if you like it and it's incongruent, can you be okay with that? And if you don't like it, but it maybe is congruent with your values, can you be okay with that? And allowing that space to exist in the connection between the three piles. You don't have to reformat everything and start all over. You actually can just focus on one thing at a time and notice how complicated it is being a self.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. I like what you said there about allowing for space. A little like Buddhist parallel drawing line just came up and I'm like, yeah, that. That's what I really like about how you talk about making room for edits and realizing the stories that we tell about other people and that we tell about ourselves. Mm-hmm. We often really lock down around them, right?
And yeah.
Yeah, so allowing for space is about that. It's about making it triple spaced and with really wide margins.
Yeah. Well, and the other thing that's interesting is like, I am a million times more likely to question your existence than to question my story could be wrong.
That's interesting. Could you unpack that a little bit?
Yeah. Like if I meet someone and I think they are wonderful and just like me, so they're going to like my same kind of music. And then you get to know them more and they hate your kind of music. It's so much more likely for me to like feel that there's some kind of caricature of themselves than it is that the assumptions and judgments I made in the beginning, nobody likes to say they're wrong, but they can get righter, right? Like, oh, this person doesn't do what I thought they did. Let me edit my story and get it righter. And then like go learn about this thing I didn't even know about this person. Like, isn't that's an exciting way to live life. But we don't do that. What we do is go, oh, why are you living so small? You're wrong. Be better. Let me tell you who you are. Why? Why do we do that?
Why do we do that? That is a very good question.
Ultimately, I think I do that so that I can feel safe and prepared. So like I've survived my life with the stories that I write to be safe and prepared for the next situation where I may be unsafe or unprepared. But that doesn't make me right.
It's sort of seeking comfort and familiarity.
Sure.
And I think also we live in a society that really tells us that knowledge is in knowing, being a knower is really important. Even though anyone who's ever had to be at a dinner party with a knower knows that it's really annoying.
Right. Well, and what would happen? What would happen if we created a habit of not knowing versus living in a habit of knowing everything?
Yeah. I mean, that is actually basically my path as a Buddhist and why I really like Buddhism so much, because that's exactly it is. It's like the habit of not knowing is that space, right? It's that when you don't know, then there's room for potential.
Mm-hmm. That's important. I'm a big fan of holding two conflicting emotions at once. That's my big takeaway from Pema Chodron's work. And it's interesting to me is that when I will define myself as being X, I force myself to figure out, okay, so if I'm X, then what is the opposite that I'm also holding? it shatters apart. It reminds me of a scene from The Matrix, because it shatters apart my sense of self that is X, but it freezes all the particles just dangerously separated from one another. And in the space of all those particles, then I am able to figure out where the opposite of that truth lives. So when I think X is happening, Y is also happening. And that actually is at the root of myself. And then that at the root of myself is where my self-awareness, my self-responsibility, my service to other people, and my social justice work stays motivated, stays energized, stays fueled, and also feels apathetic, not enough, and really just makes me want to take a nap.
Yeah, but naps are good. I mean, we do need to take more naps. I'd love for you to talk a little bit more about, you just said about self-responsibility. What are your tools around cultivating self-responsibility or cultivating awareness of self-responsibility in any given situation?
I wish I had let me tell you about my toolkit that I have alphabetized.
Not necessarily a tool, even if you just think of a particular example in your life of.
Yeah. What's weird is that I think that it's become more of a habit of listening and really looking for the patterns of what is happening around me, and then taking responsibility for it. So this is a new thing that I'm grappling with, but I still don't have the answers for. So if you or any of your listeners have any ideas, help an old lady out. But I said I'm 43, and in the last 3 or 4 years, I have had some of the most enormous, dramatic, long-term friend breakups. And part of the tragedy of losing a friend that you've been friends with for 20 years is that the friends that are currently in my life, I will not get to the same place for at least 20 more years with them. So losing someone that I've been friends with for decades, the weight of it and the investment in the history and the time is one aspect. The other aspect is that my friends now, I'm probably never going to go on a spontaneous road trip and skip class and hold their hair when they're puking in a toilet and deal with the first real love affair breakups or, you know, those kind of life things. Those aren't going to be experiences I'm going to have with these friends, even if I'm friends with them for the next 20 years. And so there's a part of me that's, you know, is Mercury in retrograde? am I having these huge, epic, dramatic fallouts with people? I just don't understand why. And so my first inclination is to start listing out why they don't take care of our friendship, why they're not invested in our friendship, et cetera. And to go to the tool question, I think that that's the easy work. So what I'm trying to do is, what do these friend breakups have in common? And I don't believe I'm doing it very well. And I feel 100% responsible for the relationships I am in. But I also notice that I'm asking for my needs to be taken care of. Maybe not in the most articulate way, but it's a new thing I'm starting to do. But I have expectations of being seen equally in spaces, mm-hmm. or basic needs, or even fancy high maintenance needs. I'm much more comfortable putting those out there. And they may or may not be received as just a need or as some kind of criticism of their being on the planet that is deeply rooted in our 20-year relationship that leads to these nuclear endings. And I'm responsible for both of those things. That's the tool in it, right? Is that when I start aiming it at them, flip it back and really figure out what is my consistent pattern that's showing up. And then again, the three piles. Okay, so I've identified a pattern. Do I like it? Do I hate it? Or is it one of those messy things in the middle that I have to figure out?
So what kind of role does humor play in all of this and all of the work that you do?
Similar to a heartbeat. I could not imagine taking on the challenging topics, the difficult conversations, just the dirt work. But I also couldn't imagine, like, the joy in my life or the amount of laughter or fun or spontaneity balancing out with the heavy, hard work if it weren't for humor. I find when I work with my audiences or my friends or my partner or my dogs that if we can laugh together, we can get one level deeper together. And when we're one level deeper together, we can laugh better with one another. And then we get another level deeper. And that's a really important thing. And in some ways, I think that that in itself is service, because we're getting through each other's layers to, like, our real core. And that level of vulnerability and authenticity and curiosity and generosity that's needed is what I believe ultimately is what humanity is about. Now I'm starting to sound like a bumper sticker, but I think I just think it's really true that the vortex of curiosity, generosity, authenticity, and vulnerability is a real human connection. And to get there, you have to use humor.
What's so wonderful about the way that you speak about things and how you share your ideas around it is that there's just this pervasive lightheartedness, even when you're talking about something that might be, you know, like earlier when you were mentioning about the Holocaust and, like, not understanding Hitler, and that there's still this, like, you're talking about something very serious, but it's the way that lightheartedness and that humor can engage a person in a conversation.
Mm-hmm.
Is it something that you grew up with? Was this modeled for you? Like, do you feel like, because you said it's like a heartbeat, is it just something that you've always done, or is it something that you felt like you cultivated over time?
That's a really good question too. I think that I've cultivated how to use it as a Jedi skill. But I feel like I grew up in a family where the Force was strong. So I got to pick. I could easily just be magically using it on the side and be a farmer in the desert. I could use it for good and I could use it for bad. I believe I have chosen to use it for good. And I believe that I have made a commitment to use it the best I can for good. So it does take work.
Yeah, no, because there's a way to be, I'm trying to think about, you know, the question I'd like to ask around it. My general thought on it is, over time, as I have learned more about the world and about other people's experience of the world, I no longer find it funny when a person is the punchline. And often when you no longer find it funny when the person is the punchline, but someone else still does, the perception is that you no longer have a sense of humor, right? This is an attitude that can be a bit pervasive in communities of people who are doing social action, is that they're very serious and they don't find things funny. But what it really is for me, for example, like, well, no, I just don't think people as punchlines is funny. But, you know, like, fart jokes, classic, hilarious, always going to be funny. There are lots of things I can laugh about. There's lots of things that you're saying in this exchange you're having where it's very lighthearted and we're laughing and it's great. And we can talk about very serious things. So I guess what it is I'm trying to ask, like, what you've learned about gauging a situation to know how to bring humor in. And what you've noticed about using humor skillfully versus using it unskillfully, either for yourself or watching it with other people.
You know, it's interesting when you're talking about it, like, the image that came up to my head, or came up into my head. What does that even mean? But the image that came to mind, I guess it did come into my head, is the difference between Prosecco in a crystal glass and, like, what I would refer to as bathtub punch in a red Solo cup.
Okay.
Okay. Both of them are beverages in a container that change the atmosphere of a party. And there are times where if I am going to engage in a conversation around social justice issues or difficult issues or history or things like this, and I am only capable of communicating like Prosecco in a crystal champagne glass. There are a lot of people I'm going to lose touch with, lose access or accessibility with, not just because of class or because of personal preferences, but because of my access to education and my access to self-work. My vocabulary is different. My expectations of other people's vocabulary is different. And that's my responsibility to get over. The key isn't the exchange of beverage. The key is the party, participating in a conversation. If I show up all the time as a red solo cup, I'm not going to get invited to some conversations. So I think that the more work that you do, the more important it is to realize that it's the work and you have to be able to flip containers based on where the conversation is starting. There isn't a elementary or 101 starting place. There's new to this and not new to this. And you might be not new on one topic and be very new at a different topic. So why don't you just engage in every conversation like it's a new conversation and see what's needed and where you can go? And I think humor can be the great equalizer, but humor can also be the quick analysis of when you're using the wrong cup.
That is a brilliant analogy.
Right? I don't think people should ever be the punchline of a joke. And some of the funniest stuff is when I am my own punchline.
Yeah, well, because it's that choice sort of thing. And I think a part of it that I'm starting to just realize and talking to you right now is that often when humor is used where the person is the punchline or where it is the wrong cup for the room, and it, you know, that feeling when it just kills the room.
Yeah.
Yeah. Is often employed out of discomfort on the part of the person who is in their attempt to be humorous, is actually using the humor almost as a shield instead of using it as, well, as a cup being extended. Like, hey.
Right. And I think actually that's a really beautiful continuation of my weird metaphor, is that the conversation has to be extended and participated in. There's also a difference between using humor and telling jokes.
Yes.
And by telling jokes, what you're doing is taking something that's fairly relatable to your audience and twisting it in an unexpected way. Mm-hmm. And sometimes the unexpected way is uneducated and ignorant. And sometimes the unexpected way is wicked smart and super fast and no one saw that coming. And the reality is that both can be laughed at or found offensive by the same person, depending on the topic. That's why jokes are risky.
Yes. Yeah. There's the risky, unless you're in the realm of dad jokes, and then you're basically safe, except that people might get eye strain. So burnout is a theme with a lot of my guests. They talk about it. It comes up often. It comes up often in these kinds of circles and people doing this kind of work. And when we're talking about workability, like we can get really locked down around having certain results and wanting change to be just so, or wanting to see something happen faster than it is. There's a lot of attitudes about wanting change now, and also taking on way more responsibility than one person should ever take on. It's basically like having a fix-it attitude. So could you talk a bit about your experience with burnout and what you have learned about being enough?
Absolutely. So this is probably the most important thing in my work right now, because about 3 years ago, I referred to that as the year of the crouton. I was beyond toast. I was as burnt out as I hope I ever get. And part of it was because I had been doing this work for over a decade. I didn't notice any difference in myself, my friends, my audiences, the questions they asked me, anything I was noticing in the world and politics. I didn't notice anything different. So 3 years ago, I was like, that's it. I think I have to quit. Because literally, I have turned into a cliche quote. And that I am expecting something different by doing exactly the same thing over and over and over again. And why would I do that? It doesn't even make any sense.
I know.
So I started paying attention to my own excuses. And I started noticing a pattern in myself. And then that same pattern I started noticing in other people. And I noticed the pattern fell into kind of archetypal patterns of social justice icons that I've done way too much research on. Mm-hmm. And then in making those connections, I realized that ultimately, myself and others, we struggle with three primary questions. So this is why I wrote my book. In writing my book, my own message literally cured my own burnout. So I am totally ecstatic to go back to work again. And I really do believe I'm doing something different that's actually resulting in different things, which feels great, right? So I'm working primarily with folks that are interested in the message. Mm-hmm. And I am available for those that are mildly interested. And I'm trying really hard not to like have my sense of pride rested on these big wins of people who have made it fairly clear they are not interested in working with us. So the three questions are human beings good people? Possibly be more specific, am I actually good? Number two is, after we get to that terrifyingly truthful answer, is that enough? And then when you realize it doesn't even matter if it's enough, it's all you've got. The truth is that I am the best tool anybody has for my work. That's utterly terrifying and a true statement. So, okay, well, if I'm like moderately good and that has to be enough, then number three is, what on earth do I do now? Now you're like self-aware in this new way, and laying on the couch and sucking your thumb is actually only entertaining for a very short period of time. So then what? What do you do? Right? Get to work. Make better connections. Do the best you can with what you got some of the time.
Some of the time. And that's a really good one. Whenever we're talking about self-care and anyone's like, yeah, take breaks.
Yeah. Go on a dog walk. Or like say you're going to go on a dog walk and then take a nap.
Whichever happens. Okay. So these three questions, these are awesome. Again, these are questions that I've done a lot of work around myself in my Buddhist path, especially the, are humans good? I always think that's a really good question to ask. I have definitively found that the answer is yes, despite popular opinion. And I guess what I'd like to ask you is, how do you test those? How do you test that first question? Are humans good? Which is really saying, are you good? Which I think is also a very important distinction to make, because often when people are like, oh, humans are awful and terrible and basically evil, I'm like, well, I don't know. I'm a human and I'm not basically evil. And I know lots of humans and they don't seem to be basically evil.
Yeah. No, you're doing exactly the thing, right? So you can't know every human and you can barely know yourself some of the time. So like, I learned this in one of those self-helpy retreat things I make myself go to as a white woman so that I have matching t-shirts.
That's where white women go. That is like our thing.
It is. You know, it's silent retreats with some reflection music. Yeah.
I can smell it. Let's go that way.
So one of the things that I learned is that if everyone is terrified, what that means is that I am terrified. And if I am terrified and you are terrified and everyone is terrified, then I shouldn't be surprised when someone acts the way I'm expecting them to, which is terrified. The evil or the bad or the selfishness or the thoughtlessness that may be occurring in the world. I have avoided the news today, but I'm sure some of it happened today in the news. if instead of coming from evil, it's coming from fear, then it's up to you whether or not you're going to pity that person or you're going to try and do something to reduce the amount of fear in the world. If I'm doing anything because I think it's going to reduce the amount of fear in the world, at the heart, that's good. Done. Question number two, is that enough? Can't know, but it's there's a friend of mine, Mike McCree, once said that, like, we generally are aware that there's a house on fire, right?
Yeah.
So, like, if a house is on fire, like, that's not the best time to mow the lawn. If the house is on fire and you pick up the garden hose, it might not put out the whole fire, but it's at least the right activity. So that's enough. This is my whole point of, like, what about the possibility of possibilities? What if it's possible there is a possible? Or, like, try to try. These teeny tiny grammar things are, like, to start some forward movement. And once you have some momentum started, that's enough.
I love it. I love this whole thing. This is something I've been thinking about a lot in the last year for some strange reason. And I think it's something, like, in conversations that we have, a big part of the general narrative I hear in the we need to save the world now from whatever it might be, patriarchy, climate change, orange presidents,
creamy peanut butter.
But there's this sense like, oh, well, if I can't absolutely as one person fix the entire problem, I shouldn't even bother.
Oh yeah, that makes total sense. I solve global warming, so you know what I'm gonna do? Light my house on fire. When did our ego get involved in the conversation about what is the right thing to do?
I know, right? And yet it is, but we don't, I think, like, I realize how often I've been blind to it. And I hear other people being blind to it. And again, with what you're saying about humor, right? Like, that's my part of humor that I inject in it. And I'm like, oh yeah, how arrogant am I? I'm going to single-handedly solve sexism.
Yeah, exactly. And if I can't, screw everybody.
Yes.
So, actually, instead of getting to screw everybody, why don't you just, like, chill out, right? Like, read a book. Make a sandwich. Call a friend. You can break this down into something tiny that doesn't result in a bonfire when you're actually trying to solve a problem that a bonfire is never going to help. Ultimately, we're doing the best we can with what we got some of the time because we are good enough now. And you're welcome. That is how I cured my burnout.
Yeah, that's fantastic. What have you learned about learning how to value the little things more?
What have I learned about doing that?
Well, about learning how to value it. Because, like, what we're saying, I mean, we're joking about how you can't, no single person is going to be some amazing superhero, swoop in and save the day, have the one solution. Even if we acknowledge that we can't do that, we then tend to minimize. I know I do this, like, you minimize the little things you do that are of benefit. There's a parable of, there's a forest fire and all of the animals are kind of standing back watching it rage. And this one hummingbird gets up and, like, goes over to a lake and picks up, like, a little beak full of water and comes back and dumps it on the forest fire and just keeps doing this back and forth. And all the other animals are like, well, what are you doing? And the hummingbird said, well, I'm doing the best I can. It's like, it seems like it's a little thing that's meaningless. And yet actually that one little thing, to continue the parable, could make one of the other animals be like, well, that's a good point. Am I doing the best I can right now? Probably not. Maybe I should help trying to put out the forest fire, you know? And so it's like, what have you learned about valuing those small actions?
So, I mean, I think this is probably the hardest question that I'm still constantly always preparing to be reminded I need to be grappling with. Right? Like, oh, it's that hummingbird thing, right? And what's amazing is that it's the most important question. And then often sounds like, ugh, well, I'm doing the best I can. No, you're not. So the script can show up in your life a lot and have a completely different meaning which I think challenges me to even try to ask the real question to begin with, because,
well, I'm doing the best I can,
is not an option. And sometimes that's as close to giving myself grace that I get, right? So then, like, then it comes back to noticing. So, okay, how many times have I said that lately? Maybe I'm not. What if there's a possibility that this isn't the best I can do? Or maybe it really is the best I can do. So why am I giving myself attitude about it just because it's not really being wildly successful? Now you're back to self-awareness work.
Fantastic. This whole conversation reminds me of a poem that I wrote called Enough. Can I read it?
Absolutely, please. Yeah. I feel I'm like such an office supply person. I was like, a poem called Enough, I could make stationery. Like, that's where my brain went. Welcome. I'm a Virgo. It's not my fault.
Fantastic. Okay. I don't usually write poems. And so then I claim that I don't write poetry. And then my wife points out that for someone who doesn't write poetry, I sure do write poems a lot.
I think it's really important for your podcast audience that you have to be self-deprecating in order to be vulnerable enough to write something that you just called a poem called Enough.
So here's the poem called Enough. Please do not doubt the significance of my gratitude when you listen to what I had to say. Please do not think less of a hug given to a friend in the midst of unspeakable heartbreak. Please do not undermine the value of your words when you questioned an implicit bias in something someone said. Do not assume responsibility for a load we are all carrying, but do not turn away from it either. Trust that while you may only be one person, you matter because you are part of something bigger. Remember this, when you cannot mend a broken bone, but you sit at a bedside and offer your hand to hold. When you cannot afford to fund a worthy cause, but you take the time to share it with others. When you cannot undo an act of violence, but you still stand and bear witness to it. When you find yourself at a loss for words, but you share the voices of those who speak with wisdom you recognize, you are doing enough.
Yeah, that's terrible.
I know, it's so bad. You know what's funny is I wrote it and published it to my blog about a year ago, I guess. And I was like, this is really like a personal pep talk.
Yeah. Well, ultimately, and just in case, because I don't think we compliment each other enough, that is beautiful and very truthful, and it is a pep talk, right? But, I mean, that's the whole concept of enough in the first place. The concept of enough is a pep talk.
Yes, I love that. What I'd love for you to do now, this is my final question, is to offer as a gift or guidance to listeners something. Like, besides reading your book, which is, I'm totally going to be including a link of that in the show description and encourage people to read the book, but what would you like to offer as a gift or guidance to listeners doing this kind of work?
So, thank you for the opportunity, first off. I think that the thing that is sometimes most important is I keep a little post-it note next to my computer. It's on my laptop all the time, but my laptop is open currently. But it's a little post-it note that has like a pie chart. Mm-hmm. It's a circle that has like a quarter piece, an eighth piece, and then the rest of the pie for the visual. And what I think is important to remember is there's three kinds of knowledge. There's what you know, there's what you know you don't know, and there's what you have no idea you don't even know yet.
That's the biggest part, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. And the more you find out what you don't know, the more questions you have about what you don't even know you don't know. It, for me, it's just a constant reminder that the more work I do, I'm not going towards a finale. The more work I do, I'm just beginning again.
You're very profound and it's pithy.
It's just the time of day.
You should write a book.
Oh my gosh, I should write a book. I'll also tell you that I have a bunch of videos on my YouTube channel, mm-hmm. and I'm trying, this is the year, 2018 is the year of videos for me, and I'm actually going to release, oh, I can't even believe I'm doing this because I hate videos so much, but I'm going to post, I'm hoping for a video a day,
wow.
that I know that's my goal. A video a day. And for the record, I started in November so that I have padding because I know that I will not do this every day. But I wanted to do something that's like under 3 minutes about something about a conversation that matters. Cool. Either something that I had, a conversation I had, conversation I need to have, a time where I got nudged or called out, or a time where there's something that needs to get called out, or something that just made me laugh, or mm-hmm. something that's just a little bit different, but it is a conversation that matters. And so I'm releasing that starting in January. And there's a bunch of other videos on my channel. If you're feeling burnt out or exhausted, or you need a good laugh, or you just want to know that you're not alone, if the videos on the channel can help at all, please feel free to watch them. They are free. There are some that are an hour long. There are some that are 2 minutes long. Cool. That's my offer.
Thank you very much. This has been delightful.
Well, it's largely due to the host.
No, you. Jessica Pettit is an author, speaker, and diversity and social justice trainer. Her book, Good Enough Now, is available through Amazon. The videos she mentions about conversations that matter are up on her YouTube channel, which is pretty great. You can find all this stuff and more through her website, goodenoughnow.com. To find out more about my work in the world, to get in touch with me, or to become a patron, visit caitlinschatch.com. The link is in the show description. This episode of Everything is Workable was made possible through the patronage of Gretchen Wagner, Julian and Shannon Hatch, Winita Budgen, and Margaret Prescott. Thank you to Tejai Moore of Moore Music for the original theme song.